Once an individual consents to the social contract, Rousseau continues, he tacitly commits himself to a rather amorphous force called the general will, a concept which has troubled students of Rousseau since the social contract was first published. At this point, Rousseau, the lover of paradox and rhetorical effects, puts the matter in what some have considered a sinister way.
Whoever refuses to obey the general will shall be constrained to do so by the whole body, which means nothing other than that he shall be forced to be free.
Forced to be free. Many agree that individuals should be compelled to obey laws with which they disagree. Rousseau contends that such compulsion is really a form of freedom. This strikes many as perverse. But consider what Rousseau says next. He believes that the social contract, in a sense, changes man's very nature.
The passing from the state of nature to the civil society produces a remarkable change in man. It puts justice as a rule of conduct in the place of instinct, and gives his actions the moral quality they previously lacked. Man acquires, with civil society, moral freedom, which alone makes man the master of himself. For to be governed by appetite alone is slavery, while obedience to a law one prescribes to oneself is freedom.
Rousseau maintains that the general will, which is not necessarily the will of all, cannot err. It is always right and just. Thus, according to Rousseau, when an individual disobeys the general will, he is caving in to his selfish appetite and personal whim. By compelling him to obey the general will, therefore, society is forcing him to be free. But what exactly is the general will? It is a concept Rousseau builds up gradually.
The general will is always rightful and always tends to the public good. But it does not follow that the decisions of the people are always equally right. We always want what is advantageous, but we do not always discern it. The people is never corrupted, but it is often misled, and only then does it seem to will what is bad. There is often a great difference between the will of all and the general will. The general will studies only the common interest, while the will of all studies private interest, and is indeed no more than the sum of individual desires.
The general will, according to Rousseau, is infallible and all-powerful. It is above and beyond the collection of individual wills. How then do we discover the general will? Rousseau says the assembly of associates, the coming together of society, can produce it under certain conditions.
From the deliberations of a people properly informed, and provided its members do not have any communication among themselves, the great number of small differences will always produce a general will, and the decision will always be good.
That the members should not communicate with each other may be puzzling. We ought to keep in mind, however, that Rousseau's world consisted of a multitude of different groups enjoying special legal privileges. Orders of the realm, towns, provinces, churches, craft guilds, chartered companies, each pushed its own interest, carving out a larger and larger niche for itself at the expense of the general good. Rousseau saw politics reduced to this shoving and clawing for group advantage. He tried to avoid this by limiting the expression of the general will to isolated individuals as opposed to groups. But if there are sectional associations, Rousseau warns, it is wise to multiply their number and to prevent inequality among them. Now Rousseau comes to the thorny problem of showing how the individual will not be tyrannized by the collective power he has helped to create. The first reason he gives is surprising, because it contradicts his previous explicit statement. Earlier, Rousseau stated that the social contract entailed the total alienation by each associate of himself and all his rights to the whole community. Now he says that only part of the power is alienated.
We have agreed that each man alienates by the social pact only that part of his power, his goods, and his liberty, which is the concern of the community.
This is only one of the many self-contradictions in Rousseau which have provoked the anger and even the contempt of his opponents. In any case, whatever protection Rousseau offers the individual is soon cut down, as he adds, but it must also be admitted that the sovereign alone is judge of what is of such concern. That is, the sovereign judges which part of the individual's goods and liberty may be claimed by the community. Sovereignty, Rousseau explains, must be total and unconditional. Again, he assures us, this is no grounds for alarm.
As the sovereign is formed entirely of the individuals who compose it, it has not, nor could it have, any interest contrary to theirs. And so the sovereign has no need to give guarantees to the subjects, because it is impossible for a body to wish to hurt all of its members, and as we shall see, it cannot hurt any particular member. The sovereign, by the mere fact that it is always all that it ought to be.
Despite the absolute power of sovereignty, some people assert that Rousseau protects individual rights through another proviso introduced into the concept of the general will. The general will must be universal. It must apply equally to all.
The general will, to be truly what it is, must be general in its purpose as well as in its nature. It should spring from all and apply to all. The sovereign power, wholly absolute, wholly sacred, wholly inviolable as it is, does not go beyond and cannot go beyond the limits of the general covenants. And thus, every man can do what he pleases with such goods and such freedoms as is left to him by these covenants. And from this it follows that the sovereign has never any right to impose greater burdens on one subject than on another, for whenever that happens, a private grievance is created, and the sovereign's power is no longer competent.
Rousseau claims that if law is the expression of the whole community, and if it must apply to everyone, then to harm one member is to harm all members. It is impossible, Rousseau continues, for the community to want to harm all of its members. Next, however, Rousseau rescinds his demand for universality.
When I say that the province of the law is always general, I mean that the law considers all subjects collectively and all actions in the abstract. It does not consider any individual man or any specific action. Thus the law may well lay down that there shall be privileges, but it may not nominate the persons who shall have those privileges. The law may establish several classes of citizens and even specify the qualifications which shall give access to those several classes, but it may not say that this man or that shall be admitted. The law may set up a royal government and a hereditary succession, but it may not elect a king or choose a royal family.